hello, listeners. Welcome back to the Dish with Tish, where the gossip is hot, the opinions are hotter, and absolutely nothing is off limits or safe. It's me, your host, Tish. And whether we're talking lawsuits or housewives, you know we're bringing the receipts, proof, timeline, screenshots, fucking everything. So pour yourself a drink, grab your favorite dish, because we're diving in. We're serving it up. We've got Diddy trial. We've got TV. And I'm just gonna get started, you guys, because this Diddy trial it's almost voyeuristic and dark at this point. I mean, it's beyond dark. It's really quite intense, but I know a few of you are like, I'm getting all my Diddy info from you. So I've got to give the people what they want. So we're just going to get into it and start again. I think I'm going to start the episodes with the Diddy stuff to just rip the Band-Aid off, just dive into it, and then we can lighten up the mood with our dishes and our TV shows. So it's week two of the Diddy trial, and it has been a week. A lot of people have been a little confused about the RICO charges and what exactly they mean. So I'm going to kind of break that down for you guys as well, on top of some of the testimony that we've seen this week, because it's been a lot. So what does any of the testimony that we've seen have to do with sex trafficking or racketeering? You know, when people think of sex trafficking, they think human trafficking, right? Like you're going to kidnap someone, lock them in a cage, very Liam Neeson Taken coded. And for some, we know that that's not the definition of sex trafficking, right? It's just that there's an interstate component. There's sex, force, fraud, and coercion. And racketeering, on the other hand, you think the mob, right? Someone shows up, knocks on your door, asks for some protection money if you want to be safe, or they shake you down, rough you up, not typically charged in these type of cases. But again, the federal government has limited jurisdiction, so they can't charge all the state crimes at federal court. But I think the prosecution has to connect these dots and explain it. And like I've said last week, I'll say it again, we're still early days. So it's still, you know, they have to make sure that the jury sees it. We see it, but I'm not sure if the jurors do yet. So we're going to move into some of the testimony. We had Don Richard from Danny D. Kane. Also, she was in a group for a little bit, Diddy Dirty Money, which was a flop. Loved Dawn. She was always like one of my favorites in Danny D. Kane. But she testified that she saw Diddy try to hit Cassie with a skillet in 2009. He came downstairs like, where are my fucking eggs? Where's my food? And she was about to make it, and he took the skillet from her and tried to hit her, and she just fell to the ground before dragging her by her hair. And then in a separate incident, she said she saw him punch her in the stomach at a dinner where other high-profile celebrities like Usher and Neo were allegedly there as well. She testified that these assaults occurred in front of people, you know, security guards, industry power players. Jimmy Iovine, who is one of the founders of Interscope Records with Dr. Dre. She suggested that there was a lot of violence, and it was tactically accepted as part of this Bad Boy Records operating culture. That's just the way that they did it. I think it's one of the worst kept secrets in Hollywood, you know, that Diddy was allegedly physically and sexually abusive, and no criminal charges have been brought to him thus far in terms of the racketeering and the trafficking. And it's because, you know, like I said last week, he really was bribing people. You know, think about the hotel security guard. We know that Diddy tried to persuade him with the Rolex and the $10,000 in cash, you know, and witnessing Diddy punching and kicking Cassie. And people have just been saying, what does this have to do with the charges? But the prosecutors are building the evidence that this is not just a pattern of domestic violence. This is racketeering. This is trafficking because this was not consensual. Like, we obviously see that there is a pattern of violence, right? But we have testimony that he is threatening people. He threatened Dawn. She said that after he assaulted Cassie in front of her, he said, if you speak out about what you saw, I will make you quote unquote disappear. And that's obstruction of justice. That's the intimidation. So you can use the violence and not only show the pattern, but to get to one of those racketeering charges, those are predicate acts. And predicate is kind of, hold on, I Googled it because it's illegal words. Because when I was doing my research, I said, what the hell does predicate mean? Yeah, in a legal context, predicate typically means something that forms the basis or foundation of another legal matter. Yes, they are just building the case to show his pattern of abuse and that these are things that are not consensual with most of the parties involved. So Dawn's testimony was very captivating, just knowing how closely she worked with him and how much she saw firsthand of Cassie being physically abused at the hand of Diddy and so many other people in Hollywood seeing and knowing it and just turning a blind eye to it. And then we got testimony from Carrie Morgan, who's Cassie's ex-best friend, saying that during a Jamaica vacation, she witnessed Diddy dragging Cassie by her hair, because that's apparently kind of one of the main forms of abuse that he would do is grab her by her hair and drag her around. And Morgan revealed that she too was allegedly physically assaulted by Diddy. So her testimony about the violence that she literally suffered at the hands of Diddy and why this particular incident could be crucial for the racketeering case, because she described this alleged brutal attack by Diddy. Apparently, he struck her with a coat hanger so violently that she claims she suffered a concussion. And the context that she says was that he was interrogating her about Cassie's supposed infidelity. But it's kind of legally significant because after the attack, Morgan testified that Diddy allegedly paid her $30,000 in cash in exchange for signing an NDA, actually done through Cassie. He had Cassie be the one to give her the cash and pass the NDA. So, does this qualify as witness tampering? I think it does, because now you see a pattern of violence. Diddy is paying people to make it go away. Obviously, we saw him unsuccessfully try to do this to get the surveillance video from the hotel. And now he's paid Morgan for her silence and We know, of course, an NDA can't prevent a witness from testifying. And that's another question that I've gotten before. There's legislation shouldn't even invalidate NDAs in sexual assault and sexual harassment cases. But again, you can see the pattern of violence. Diddy paying someone for their silence. It can be intimidation. It's obstruction for those. And that's something that comes up too, because if you listen to last week's episode, like I was saying, Israel Flores from the Intercontinental Hotel, he told the court that immediately after the assault, he locked eyes with Diddy and he muttered the words, "Don't tell nobody," quote unquote, tried to give him cash, the Rolex. Flores says he refused. But does it have to be that he was going to be a potential witness in a pending investigation? Or does attempting to suppress future testimony, is that enough for bribery? Someone was the witness to a felony, you know? You're trying to dissuade them from reporting it to law enforcement. So that's the argument that I would make, that this is someone who is a potential witness to domestic violence and it is 1,000% a bribe. And we know Cassie's testimony painted a extremely disturbing picture that she described after years, 11 years in this relationship, and after their 2013 trip, he did play recordings of some of the freak-offs to her, basically suggesting that he would release them to humiliate her. And this is another form of intimidation. This is a form of keeping quiet. And she said it created a climate of fear where she felt she couldn't refuse his demands, that she was constantly terrified of these blackmail videos being made public. And then she says after they landed, he wanted a freak off, so he got a freak off. And now the alleged threats weren't limited to Cassie. We know Don Richard recounted that after the skillet incident, he said, you know, he's going to make her disappear after she revealed what she saw. And then Cassie's mother was on the stand as well, and she revealed that she was forced to wire $20,000 in cash. She was forced to take out a home loan equity after he allegedly threatened to release explicit videos of her daughter. And Regina testified that she paid out of fear for Cassie's safety. So you have pretty strong evidence of blackmail and extortion, right? First from Cassie herself. She participates in the freak-off because she was threatened by Diddy. And now Don Richard is being threatened that she'll go missing. And the best, of course, is Regina Ventura, Cassie's mom, that she took out this loan. And on Christmas Day, mind you, it was Christmas Day because he was so upset that Cassie was now in a relationship with Kid Cudi, and he wanted to be paid for some of the expenses that he had paid for Cassie throughout their relationship. So she wired that money and it was returned without explanation 4 or 5 days later, but that's too late. It's still, that's textbook extortion. And it's a RICO predicate. And the testimony that Cassie provided last week was so emotional. And this isn't just a domestic violence case, but this is participation in a criminal enterprise, meeting the legal definition of sex trafficking. And she detailed how Combs staff would allegedly facilitate all these elaborate sexual encounters, the freak-offs, getting the supplies, replenishing materials, handling post cleanups, booking the hotels, multiple cities, Miami, LA, Ibiza. And remember the transportation elements for sex trafficking. And she testified that she herself was even instructed to source and vet escorts online, arrange for their travel pay, pay them thousands of dollars in cash, or the security team. And she really hammered in on those elements that would make this not consensual, highlighting that she feared for her life and blackmail of these recordings coming out. So she felt unable to refuse his demands because he was in complete control of her. Okay, now I want to get into the arson, which is actually another underlying predicate crime for racketeering. And this came up in reference to a big name that we got to testify today, my Cleveland King, Mr. Kid Cudi. So during Cassie's testimony last week, she told the jury that Diddy threatened to blow up Kid Cudi's car when he found out that she was dating him in 2011. And around that time, he made this a threat to blow up the car. And then the fucking car blew up. It literally blew up, y'all. He blew up this nigga's car. And Cassie even went out to say that the next time she saw Cudi, she was with Diddy. And he asked him, like, what about my vehicle? Like, what happened to my car? And he's telling people, including Cassie and Kid Cudi, you know, that he's going to take matters into his own hands. And she was fearful, so she got back with him, seeing what he's capable of. And not only what he's capable of, but that he's actually going to make it happen, make it a reality. So that's another reason why she went back. So even for that alone, that's a RICO conspiracy charge right there. Just the That's a strong case for an arson, you know, predicate for sure. But let's talk about Kid Cudi for a second, because I've never seen someone make an entrance in a court like this, looking so cool, calm, collected, smoking a cigarette, the leather jacket, the whole deal. But, you know, each one of these witnesses, it's just creating unsurmountable mountains of evidence against Diddy. And a woman named Capricorn Clark, who was an employee of Diddy, she was basically forced to ride in the car with Diddy to Kid Cudi's house. And then she was fearful and liked Kid Cudi, so she called him to tell him that some other people were at his house and inside your house right now, and I'm really scared. So that's super important to separate from the fact that there was a Molotov cocktail in the fucking Porsche in another kidnapping, almost kidnapping. You know, this woman was forced against her will to be in the car as they're going to blow up another car. And Cudi said when he came home, his dog was locked in the bathroom. So this is two separate incidents. The first time he came home, his dog was locked in the bathroom, so he knew that someone had been in his home. And then he got the call from this Capricorn Clark, and she told him that they were outside of his house. And that's when the Porsche exploded. But Kid Cudi was very compelling in his testimony. The lawyer that was brought in, Brian Steele, fresh from the Young Thug trial down in Atlanta. I think maybe he was brought in because of kind of his prominence, I guess, now in these sort of cases. But my read on it was that Kid Cudi was kind of deferential and was like, okay, Mr. Steele, and I could tell you something. You said that. No, wait. And just the back and forth, he was just very charismatic and like he was not scared. And I just respect that he was willing to go up there and speak his truth. But yeah, even with the sort of celebrity buzz in our culture, and especially with this case, he was a really good witness. And he spoke very articulately, and there wasn't much to disagree with. I think Brian Steele was a little blown away. He basically just wanted him to admit that there were no criminal charges brought about the burning of the car. He said, sort of without foundation, there was also female DNA found in the car, and that seemed to be a big hit for them that they believed to be. Kid Cudi also said that 2 years after all this, Diddy essentially apologized to him about it and didn't really have much to say about the matter. But I think it's very persuasive evidence for the RICO charges, especially arson. It's one of those allegations. And remember, they only have to establish two of these charges over the course of a 10-year period of time. So it's a very broad timeline that they have. And I think that they've already kind of established the enterprise element that they need for the RICO charges. And even the conspiracy of it all, it doesn't have to be Diddy himself, which is an important distinction to make. You think that they have the criminal agreement aspect of racketeering proven. That's one of the most important parts of the RICO violations. It was designed essentially for mafia things where you have a criminal organization or enterprise for profit. And the enterprise here, of course, is Bad Boy Records. And the defense is going to argue there's no advances, the actual enterprise, common purpose, that they just were working for Diddy to make him happy. His attorneys are definitely clocking in and trying to discredit people. I know with Dawn Richard, when she was on the stand, they brought in their new lawyer from Georgia, the ninth member of the dream team for Diddy, Nicole Westmoreland, straight off the YSL trial in Atlanta. And I have to say, she went hard on Dawn. She questioned her about a lot of the interviews that Dawn has done with the government, and she hadn't necessarily said the same story per se. And she really highlighted for the jury some inconsistencies in the various tales that Dawn had told. But she remembered more and more the more she thought about it. And also questions about her civil lawsuit and that she had a monetary gain in testifying against him. And I mean, sometimes people's stories change when it's trauma. You know, that's, I know they're trying to discredit her and say your story's changing. And initially, when she was questioned, she brought up Usher and Jimmy Iovine and Neo. And initially, she didn't mention them. And they said, wait, but weren't there notable people there? And she said, yeah, there were. And the attorney said, well, then why didn't you say that? And she's like, well, because I'm just going off of what I told the lawyers already. And she's like, yeah, but that's not what you said on this day. So it's a lot of, you know, just trying to discredit her. Same with Cassie. I know they shared a picture of her, like a scantily clad picture, and basically were like, well, if you dress like this, aren't you asking for it? And it just, I mean, I know that they're trying to do their job, but it's truly just like victim blaming and shaming. And it is just so nasty. And I know an application was filed by the press basically because they're not putting all of their information into the dockets for the press to see. They're basically trying to redact as much as possible, trying to take things out for the press. And they're trying to basically put their notes in 8 days later, and that's not really how trials like this go. It's usually the night of. So they're literally trying all the stops to get this man acquitted. And yes, another thing I want to talk about is they had the special agent with Homeland Security who was instrumental in the raids on Diddy's properties. Just to give you an idea about some of the things that were found, they found heels, phones and shoes, sex toys, drugs, guns that were intended for distribution. And I believe one of the underlying crimes for racketeering, this could definitely help them with this case because there were several loaded AR-15s with full loaded magazines, you know, just to contribute to the culture of fear. And then there was Don Hughes, a psychologist who specializes in sex, trauma, psychological principles about trauma, domestic violence. She spoke about the coping mechanisms that Cassie went through and how she felt like she couldn't get out of the relationship because he controlled every aspect of her life. And then we had George Kaplan, and this was explosive testimony. George Kaplan was a former Diddy executive assistant who revealed some stunning gag-worthy details about the drug pickups, the secret hotel room setups. And he painted Diddy as a demanding boss, and he used him to get drugs. And sometimes he would get scripts in his name, and he was repeatedly threatening his job. We were first introduced to George. We were wondering what was going to happen, and he invoked his Fifth Amendment right outside of the presence of the jury. And in exchange for that, he was given a court-ordered immunity deal, which is why he was so forthcoming about the details of his job under the employment of Diddy, which is not handed out like lightly. They do not give out immunity deals like that, especially in the Southern District of New York. And he used to work at Nickelodeon, which I'm also like, ooh, girl, your track record is not it. But he worked for Diddy for 2 years from 2013 to 2015. And he said sometimes he would work anywhere from 80 to 100 hours a week. There were at various times he was told that he would be fired for not doing exactly what Diddy asked him to do. So that is pretty interesting. And also, one last thing, there's a man, a John Doe, and the judge was given his name and they tried to dismiss. He has a civil suit against Diddy for rape not that long ago in Miami. And he is trying to sue as a John Doe, but I think they are going to reveal his identity. And Diddy's lawyers attempted to dismiss the case yesterday, and the judge denied the motion to dismiss it in its entirety. So his case will be going forward, and you can see a lot of parallels in the civil suit also tied in with this criminal case. So it's definitely been a crazy, crazy week with the Diddy trial. There's still a lot to happen, and now, you know, there have been some more big stars' names thrown into it. There's been a lot of really intense witnesses and testimony, and I just appreciate the women who are stepping forward. You know, I'm writing an article right now basically about the for the Substack, which, by the way, if you are not subscribed, make sure to get some extra content. There's just a lot of discourse and negativity surrounding three names in particular. And it's Cassie getting hate for calling out Diddy. It's Megan Thee Stallion getting hate for being shot by Tory Lanez and him getting stabbed in prison. And it's Halle Bailey and DDG. And it really is disgusting to me because when a black man is dealt with violence. Everyone is quick to stand up and defend the man, as they should. But when it comes to black on black, directly black men on black women, the women get shamed and are bullied, not for letting the black man get away with his mess, even finding excuses. And Cassie, Hallie, and Megan are three black women that have been blamed, publicly judged, social media just dragged, and it's a disturbing pattern against them. And it's really exhausted to be reminded time and time again that no matter the context or community, men are always centered before women. And within the black community, that reality takes on another painful layer. And I just appreciate all of these women for having the courage to get up there, look him in the eyes, tell their side, and not look back. And it's just a shame that this is kind of the reality that we live in, but it is. And I'm gonna keep talking about this trial because, like I said, I know a lot of you are getting your information from me about this, and it's a lot. It's heavy, but it's also, I think it's important to show that it doesn't matter how much money you have or how powerful you are, if you are harming and ruining lives and crossing these, it's not even boundaries. It's so much more than that. But you have to be held accountable. Diddy or not, it doesn't matter. We've pled our case, and now it's time to plead guilty to some binge watching and some of our shows. So we're going to move on to some lighter topics. We had our Summer House finale. As much as I'm sad that it's over, I'm kind of glad that it is, because when I think about how much time I've spent talking about the Lexi and Jesse breakup of it all, then the course of their actual relationship, we all need to take a collective break and move on from this nonstop talk about this relationship that was a blip in the radar. I appreciate them because they did genuinely carry the season. Like, most of it was truly about their relationship. But, it's so exhausting because the reunion's not even out yet, and they have been on all the podcasts, all the shows, and they're trying to basically tell their side of the story. And these interviews come out around the same time as an episode, and it's not necessarily a great look, and it puts the internet into overdrive, and everyone's already so fed up of their fucking relationship and them just defending themselves nonstop. It's just making it so much worse. So I think I can speak for myself. I'm excited to put it behind me. And I'm sure everyone else in the house is as well. But yeah, we got little bits and pieces of everyone else's stuff and their opinions. Obviously, Lindsay and Carl, a little Kyle and Amanda, the undercurrent of Paige about to break up with Craig, Sierra, and West. But I mean, if you're gonna define this season, you're definitely gonna think of Lexi and Jesse for sure. So they can take a bow. As irritated as I get, I do have to like appreciate them for providing that content. You know what I mean? Like, when it was good, we were in it, fully in it. And I'm sure the reunion will be great, and hopefully the questions get answered. But I feel like they're, yeah, like I said, they've just been doing so many Q&As and Instagram and podcasts, Watch What Happens Live. Like, we've already had the reunion. And sometimes I hate when people just are so quick to go to the press. I'm like, save some of it, because we're already fatigued of this month-old relationship. So Lexi had a lot to say where the blame is to lie in terms of her relationship with the girls. But I think what Lexi is trying to say is Jesse purposefully created this space and narrative between Lexi and the girls. And I do feel like it falls somewhere in the middle of the two, but it wasn't just being lost, you know, like her relationship with the girls. Because people chimed in and had different opinions on things. And also, Lexi put so much pressure on herself with it being the final weekend and her wanting to bond with the girls. And thankfully, she did have Gabby and Lindsay there for her. And also, side note, the best thing Wes said all season was when he clocked Gabby and said, "You can't really sit here and talk about other people's stuff and you're not bringing anything to the table." I said, he's not wrong. He is not wrong. Like, where's your relationship at, Gabby? If she doesn't want to have one, that's one thing, but you can't really call other people out and try to hold people accountable and you're not really bringing anything. I literally be forgetting that Gabby's there sometimes because I'm like, what, when did you get here? You know, like, when did you show up? Unless you got something negative to say. And, you know, even with West, them bringing up West and Sierra, I feel like there was such a, we caught the difference between the two because Sierra and West actually had a foundation. They had a friendship. And like Sierra said, West didn't just focus on his relationship with Sierra. Like, as much as they were into each other, he did make an effort to get to know everyone else and build relationships with the other people in the house. And I think that Lexi and Jesse were so caught up with each other. And that's the difference between the two. Lexi doesn't have any previous relationships with anyone in the house really to fall back on, versus Jesse, he does. And the fact that she is understandably hypersensitive to feeling as though he made her out to be quote unquote crazy. So I think that's very frustrating for her. And I think that their conversations in the finale was expressed in that, even if it wasn't entirely accurate. Because now here she is, like, technically single for the first time all summer, being in the house and realizing that the relationship with the other girls was not in a place where she wanted it to be. And I do think that that's a very unique thing with this show and this experience is, you know, when she goes upstairs and you see her crying, for some of those reasons, it's like she's having this realization of, like, fuck, I can't stand this man, but he's also the person that I'm closest to. Up until this point, he's been my comfort person. Even if there aren't lingering feelings of positivity, it's that loss of intimacy. And it's like, oh, I want to share how I'm feeling with this person. And what she was experiencing in real time was that the person that she wanted to talk to about what was going on is also the person that she has to be in this house with and see him flirt with other girls. And I think that that's a really, really hard thing to deal with. And, you know, she's not at home. She can't talk to her other friends. You know, she can be stuck with the other girls in the house who have a clear dynamic together. And there's an allegiance with Jesse. And she also feels like some of them have preconceived notions about her. So it's, I'm sure that's a really isolating and hard experience. So I'm glad that she does have Gabby and Lindsay, like I said, even if they are kind of in a different category than Amanda and Paige and Sierra. I think she kind of lumps them together as being the ones who had these ideas about her. But it was good for her to have at least some friends in the house. And I did think it was so funny when she's like, "Do you know what it's like to live with your ex in the same house?" And Lindsay didn't get mad. I was like, okay, that's a growth for Lindsay because Lindsay's like, honey, honey, you think your 1 month relationship, situationship, breakup is awkward for one more weekend. I've been living in the same house with my ex-fiance while I'm pregnant with another man's baby on a TV show. So please have several seats. And then the freedom dinner, chow. Oh my God. Can we just acknowledge how fucking crazy that was? Like, we just gotta laugh. If you can't laugh at anything, that's the moment, because that's the shit I live for on the show, truly. And even Wes was trying to not reveal his overwhelming happiness over Sierra giving him a little compliment. And that was sweet. The relationships between Sierra and West, I think why it hit so hard for Sierra is because they did have such a genuine connection and foundation and friendship. But the ironic thing to me is that Jesse and Lexi almost seem more serious than Sierra and West because they were so quick to label themselves and put a name to it, whereas Wes obviously and Sierra too were not willing to do that and definitely played it a slow burn long game. I mean, didn't really go that long, but you know, they appear to have a more deep connection, but it's obvious that Lexi and Jesse were kind of just playing house. And these are two people who truly don't know each other. I've said it time and time again, and they just move so quickly living together. And on your first date, you're literally living together. So I can't blame them for playing house. It makes sense, but it's just so glaringly obvious that that relationship was way too fast. And another thing I really, oh gosh, I love this moment when they were talking and Jesse kind of said, "I'm on a reality show. I'm talking to my friends. What do you want me to do?" And, you know, if this was a few years ago, that would definitely be like out of the norm, breaking the fourth wall. But I feel like it's gotten to a point on most of these shows where it's kind of unavoidable to have these conversations because the show is a part of their life and they do have to balance it because, you know, you never want to watch a show and feel like it's so overwhelmingly aware that they're on camera. But I do feel like we've arrived, like we're at a place where, like, yeah, we have to have these conversations and it really allows you to have a full grasp and understand of what it's like to be with someone in a relationship who's filming a reality show and allowing it to be a plot point, you know, because we're hip to it as the audience. We know what's going on, so we understand that they're on this show and it puts pressure on it to create a different dynamic. And yeah, I just appreciate them acknowledging that giant elephant in a room, honey. And even the Paige going over to Lindsay's house with Amanda, that was very sweet. Drinking the breast milk out of the shot glasses really sent me. And honestly, like, it's so crazy to even think about Paige and Craig being together for as long as they were, because I even the really good moments that were so sweet, like the chicken and all of that, I can't even picture them together anymore. You know what I mean? I like, obviously, there was a mutual attraction. They had so much fun together. You know, he was all in, but just thinking of her journey and where she is now, I'm happy for both of them, honestly. Like, he seems to be in a much better place. He's moved on, a new relationship. He's been jet setting with his new girl, and she's having a true, fully formed career that she's wanted her entire life and has entered this new, incredible era of her life. And I'm so happy for her. And honestly, I'm glad that was just short and brief. There was no tears left to cry. And it did kind of feel like she was back. This whole season, you could just tell it was something lingering, and she was so anxious and not herself and very removed. So you could see even those little brief few minutes, I was like, oh, that's my girl. She's back. She's free. She's finding herself again and choosing herself. And I'm happy for her. On to the next. I mean, she's literally the sky's the limit. The sky's the limit, honey. But speaking of dissecting relationships on camera, we got to talk about the Valley child. Oh my God. Oh God, it's a lot. They're going through a lot of shit. And I'm like, maybe this wasn't the best time to be making a reality show. But then again, I don't know if any of them would be on the show because they're kind of all a little bit of a mess right now for the most part. Oh, I'm just kind of frustrated. I think it's a miscommunication, but there's so much online commentary. Everyone's like, what's the big deal? Everyone was drinking. It's not so bad that Danny decided to take a nap after he got drunk instead of being a hot mess like, a Jax or a Jesse. And honestly, I love Nia. I really do. So I don't have overwhelmingly strong opinions on this in general, because the point has to be clarified. Their issue wasn't that he got drunk. No one's ever gotten drunk before. Come on. Of course, they're all fucking lit. Hello. That wasn't the thing that they were upset about. It was the feeling as though she was trying to downplay it. And I find that to be the most annoying part. Like, why didn't you guys just ask me? At no point did any of them say to her, he may be tired, but also drunk. At that point, if she had denied it, that would be a totally different story. But the second she was confronted about it, she was like, oh, by the way, he's also drunk. Like, it was so strange. Like, that's what y'all want to keep fighting for. This is the hill you want to keep dying on. And then when they were all talking about it at Brittany's house and where they had the chef dinner, and she was saying, I think she was so upset because they were talking about it after she left. And I understood that because it's more. At least give me the chance to be honest. If I lie, then come for me. Let's go there. But like, you didn't even give me a chance to tell you. You didn't even ask me. And they were just using this as a tiny example to illustrate the overall problem that they have with her covering things up or trying to pretend like life is perfect. And it wasn't a good one because she was willing to talk about it, and I think just seeing that her immediate reaction is to make things all butterflies and rainbows triggered something to, they were like, we just hate that you do this. And at Brittany's house, she kind of explained in her confessional the reason that maybe she's like this, and she told them this really beautiful, vulnerable story about why she leans into the positivity. And that's, she focuses on that because what has happened to her in her childhood and her upbringing. And it was so illuminating just learning more about her background as to why she is the way that she is. And I feel honestly like maybe those should have been separate conversations, because the second that Danny's potential quote unquote drinking problem is brought into it, the whole thing goes awry. It's like, I wish that moment could have been acknowledged as a true understanding and beautiful moment, because it made me emotional watching it, because I really love Nia. I think that she genuinely seems like a really sweet, down to earth person. And I wish they could have just understood that better as to why she may approach things the way that she does, because it was just a beautiful moment. And then separately have that honest conversation about the drinking and perhaps the way it makes other people feel on the show, particular Jasmine. I understand her viewpoint, especially, the point she made about being a lesbian, being in a gay relationship, especially with women. People don't take you as seriously. And, she felt demoralized, especially with her girlfriend being violated too. They were also expressing that they felt like she was bringing those things up to deflect again from the conversation about Danny. And they weren't sure, like, what one had to do with the other. But I did see the connection and I understood why she was explaining. And she said in her confessional what the connection between just wanting to keep things light and happy and positive, and they weren't understanding that. And I almost think it backfired, which is just so frustrating because you want to be vulnerable. You want to take a real moment. And it's just such a disconnect. And I like Mia so much. And I honestly like her more than Janet, way more. And even if Nia does things that are wrong or annoying, I'm like, it's fine. It's still better than Janet. But I genuinely think she's a really sweet person. And they talked about this in the after show about the way that they approach their issues and their relationship. And Nia said, it would be unnatural for me to go talk shit about my husband, to go to my friends, because we talk about it in therapy. I talk about it in individual therapy. We have couples therapy, group therapy. We have a whole way that we process these things. And she wasn't saying that they don't have issues. She said, we certainly have issues, but we handle them in our own way. And I think it's obviously that this is entirely fair and healthy, and clearly they do the work. But I do, going back to the fourth wall conversation, there is something to be said, like, okay, babe, you are on a reality show, and no one is saying that you have to go against your husband. But I think in an ideal world, we would want her to be a little more consistent with who she is and also sharing a little more. It just feels like something's gotta give a little bit. I feel that their constant default is, we handle things the way that we do, period. And that works in real life 1,000%. But at the end of the day, y'all are on a reality TV show that is partially about your relationship. So you do kind of have to, there's an expectation. You're entitled to boundaries. Absolutely, that is your right. But you have to share something. It doesn't have to be your whole soul. You don't have to go full Jackson Britney. I just think that the constant worry we deal with in our own time, it's okay. So you don't have to deal with it in real time, but even if you just give us a little recap, like, hey, we talked about it in therapy. Here's how it went. Like if I'm someone on the show, if I'm Britney, I can understand how that could be a little frustrating. But it's weird for me to even say that because I love Nia a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot. But at the end of the day, you are choosing to be on a reality show. Yeah, it's just a weird thing to even comment on because I do believe in having boundaries. And sometimes it is like, oh, this should not be on TV. But yeah, you have to give a little bit. I don't know if you guys saw Janet and Jason on Watch What Happens Live this week, but the way Andy was like basically yawning, you could tell he is not. I mean, they're just so boring. And talk about hiding stuff. I don't know. I'm like, you guys can't be that boring. They're like doing the newlywed game, basically writing on the boards. And it's like, what's your favorite position? Missionary. Where's the craziest place you've had sex? The couch. Girl, why are you on TV? You have to meddle in everyone else's shit because you're boring as hell. Y'all are not giving us anything. Everything's about everybody else, but let's talk about the husbands. Let's talk about what's going on with you and why y'all are so bland. I mean, truly fucking mayonnaise. So One more show we've got to talk about is Atlanta before we get into the dishes, because Atlanta has that the end of that episode really upset me. It really upset me because I used to ride for Porsche, and the way it has just taken a complete 180, I just felt so bad for Shamia, because I'm like, if I'm your friend and you're being this dismissive to me when I'm respectfully baring my soul, I would be so deeply, deeply hurt by that. Especially when the issue to begin with was that Portia has been so dismissive in handling the way that she's been feeling. That's Shamia's number one problem. And Portia just was so victim. I mean, it was her crying and being like, I can't take anymore. I understand you're going through a divorce. You have a lot on your plate. That's hard. But your friend is literally, first of all, you made it a public issue, and your friend is confiding in you about how she feels because she's almost felt scared to tell you thus far how she's been feeling. And you're yawning, you're checked out, you take a phone call, the sit down lunch, and to continue that behavior and not even be fully engaged in listening and understanding. It was just such a mistake on Portia's part. It just makes me sad because they've been friends for over 20 years, and they're still fighting in real time. They're beefing, posting stuff about each other, and I hate it. I hate it because you can see two women sitting across from each other with so much love and history who are now letting the show get in the way of all of that. And I think Portia's been so used to being the main one on the show. She's the one that's had this platform. And now Shamia's coming in. She has her own voice. She has these relationships with the women. And I think it's somewhat stepping on Portia's toes. And I don't think Shamia's intentional in doing that. She probably thought it was going to be fun. Like, yeah, I'm doing this show with my bestie. This is great. And Portia's like, this was my thing. And I understand it's probably an uncomfortable dynamic shift to adjust, especially again, she's been used to being front and center. But that doesn't mean that Shamia, like, why not share it together? I don't know. Whenever any of my best friends get something, I'm like, period. I make it, you make it. I love that. I would be so excited to be able to experience all of these things with my best friend and be like, oh my gosh, we can talk about the camera people, we could talk about this, that, the third. But Portia is just not having it, and she's playing the victim, and she's throwing in other things and not taking any accountability. And I just hate to see it. And I am hoping that they can maybe get back together at some point. Maybe the reunion, they can hash some shit out, but it's not looking good. It's not looking good. So those are some of the shows that I have been watching, and I know you guys have been too, but I'm gonna get into my dishes. I mean, overall, my breakfast, lunch, and dinner this week was Cowboy Carter. As most of you know, I went to the concert and I got my whole fucking life. It was so incredible. She is such a revolutionary, visionary, icon, legend. And I just love her so much. I love this tour too because it's so, everything with Beyoncé is intentional. Every tour date that she picked was significant to something. Like she opened with 5 days in LA, and it was the anniversary of the LA riots and uprising. And Chicago obviously is, Fred Hampton and the Great Migration. Atlanta the Black Mecca, Houston, her roots, even London. She's going there, and it's right before the Notting Hill Renaissance Fair, which started as a Black form of resistance. And going to Paris, James Baldwin and Josephine Baker and Black creatives really being able to thrive there. Everything is so intentional, and I just love her so much. Just witnessing her in the flesh, in her glory, it really is nothing like it. It's truly the best experience anyone could get. So if you have the opportunity to see Beyoncé run, don't walk, sprint, because it will change your life. It really will. So that's kind of, I've been riding that wave, but I'll say that my appetizer this week is I saw the new Final Destination, Bloodlines, and I really liked it, you guys. If you didn't know, I'm a bit of a horror buff. Well, I'm a movie buff in general. Y'all know this, but I love horror movies. And I gave it a 3 on my Letterboxd. I gave it 3 stars out of 5. I really liked the lore that they built. And they were able to kind of tie it to all of the previous movies, and they can still potentially do more. And I thought that that was really cool. I liked how emotional it was and the connections. I know one of my friends I saw it with was like, "When are they gonna start killing people again?" But I like the build up and the, seeing why all these fucking people are dying in these insane ways. I really appreciated it. So that was a good little app. My main course this week is going to be The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. I ate it up. I ate it up. I'm gonna get into it next week. We're gonna dish about it because I still kind of need to process it because I binged the whole series, not out in one sitting, but it was pretty quickly. So I do want to kind of get my thoughts together because it was a lot to digest. Oh my lord. But it kept me entertained, and that cliffhanger, ooh, I there's word on the street is the second half of the season is coming out this year. I'm praying that it does because if I have to wait another year after that cliffhanger, after that finale, I'm gonna be pissed. So yes, that is definitely my main course. And then my dessert is the Survivor finale. Spoiler alert. I am glad that Kyle won because this season of Survivor has very much been kumbaya. I'm gonna be a good person. I'm not gonna do anything shady. And I mean, so much of Survivor is outwit, outplay, outlast. And you could still be a good person and play a good strategic game. And I think that Kyle did exactly that. I think he's a great guy. He's so hot. He's loyal. But he also played strategy. You don't have to be a full Boston Rob and be conniving and sneaking and all that, but you do have to play a game. You have to play the game. You can't just win the challenges and not do anything else. You have to give us a little more than that. If I'm on the jury, I need more than that. I need to know that you didn't just win challenges. There's so many like people who have won that aren't good at challenges, but they know how to play the game. I always think of Sandra, one of the queens of Survivor, two-time winner, terrible at challenges, high key intentionally because she's not trying to do all that, which is so, I get her so much. But she's won 2 times because she knows how to play the game. And if I'm on the jury, I'm not voting just for physical ability. I want to know what game moves you did to win. So I'm glad that Kyle won because him and Camilla they ran the game. They ran the season. And will I watch this season again? Probably not. Maybe for some of the cuties, because there were some cuties on there, but for like actual gameplay, I don't think so. It was not yeah, I know a lot of people did not even finish it because they were like, it's boring. There's nothing happening. You know it's boring when there's a vote for someone and they just say, hey, Mitch, it's you're gonna go home. And he's like, oh, okay. Like, there's no kind of strategy, there's no discussion. It's just like, yes, you're gonna be sent home. Like, damn, that's that. And with that, this case is closed. The tea is spilled and the verdict is in. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Dish with Tish. Please make sure you like, subscribe, follow us at The Dish with Tish Pod on Instagram. Make sure you subscribe to that Substack. Pledge your allegiance to me. And court is adjourned. I'll see you guys next week. Bye.